right livelihood. This is the least helpful of the factors. Having abandoned dishonest livelihood, you keep your life going with right livelihood. Well, thank you. Elsewhere in the canon, the Buddha gives a few examples. Wrong livelihood includes selling weapons, selling living beings to be killed, or selling living beings to be made slaves. Selling meat, selling intoxicants, and selling poison. Those are a list of five types of wrong livelihood in terms of selling. There are also two stories where people come and they ask the Buddha his opinion on their profession. One of them is a professional soldier and the other is a professional actor. And the professional soldier says, "My teachers who taught me my soldiering skills told me that if I die in battle, I will go to the heaven of heroes." And this is what the Buddha's thinking about that. And the Buddha says, "Don't ask." And he asks a second time, and he asks a third time. And in India, asking a question three times meant you're really serious, you really wanted the answer. The Buddha says, "Okay, if you really want to know, if you die in battle while you are thinking, may this person die, may this person suffer misfortune, may this person be exterminated, that's greed, aversion, and delusion right there. And then you go to the hell of heroes." Yeah. And the soldier starts crying. And the Buddha says, "See, that's why I told you not to ask." And the soldier said, "I'm not crying because of what you told me, I'm crying because I was deceived by my teachers." And the same with the actor. The actor was told that if you die after entertaining people with your acts, that you will go to the heaven of laughter. And the Buddha says, "Don't ask." And finally, after asking three times, the Buddha finally answered him, "Okay, if your intention while you're acting is to give rise to greed, aversion, and delusion in your audience, you're going to go to the hell of laughter." Now, the hell of laughter is a very different place from the heaven of laughter. The heaven of laughter, they're laughing with you, and the hell of laughter, mm-hmm. they're laughing at you. So, again, the actor breaks down and cries for the same reason. Now notice how the Buddha handled the situation. One, his etiquette was that he's not going around saying people should not be actors and soldiers. It was not a personal campaign. He had to be asked three times before he could even say this. And then thirdly, it was your motivation. Now being a soldier, you're out there shooting people. It's obviously your motivation is you want them to die. But in the case of the actor, there's a little bit of opening for actors. And they're totally condemned. If your motivation is to act in a way that people find inspiring or educational, okay, that's okay. However, you do realize this is why you don't see actors and actresses palling around with Theravada monks.
What's your gear? Palling
around
with the Dalai Lama.
Well, they pal around with the Tibetan monks. Yeah. The Tibetan monks, they don't have this. But the Buddha's etiquette here is important. He's not out there on a campaign. He wants you to reflect on your livelihood. He also has a list of things for monks on how monks should not engage in raising livelihood, called scheming, persuading, hinting, belittling, and pursuing gain with gain. Two of those terms require explanation. Belittling, tell somebody, "I don't think you're up to making a large donation." "Oh, yeah, not." So you don't grow belittling in hopes of getting more out of people. Pursuing gain with gain is giving little presents to people in hopes that they'll give you something more in return. And that's wrong livelihood for monks. What it comes down to is the Buddha wants you to reflect on your livelihood. Is it harming people? Is it giving rise to more greed, aversion, and delusion either in you or in other people? And how honestly are you conducting it? Those are the questions you want to ask about your livelihood. Because if your livelihood is not pure in those ways, it makes it hard for the mind to settle down. Get a good concentration. Any questions on the right livelihood?
I'm sorry, but there's all that stuff about selling.
slaves and weapons and meats and poisons and stuff. Well, what about the people who make the meats and poisons and weapons?
Well, it's made to sell, right?
But you also might use those things.
For yourself?
Yeah.
Okay, well, it's not wrong livelihood if you make a fuse yourself. But then the question is, if you're poisoning something, you're going to kill it. That goes back to wrong action. About, you know, the issue on not killing. You know, the Buddha didn't say don't strike. There's a rule for monks, we're not supposed to hit people, mm-hmm. except in self-defense. So we are allowed to hit, but not with the intention to kill. So he's not leaving you totally defenseless. And this is one of the reasons why the Shaolin monks became the Shaolin monks. So that they could disarm the opponent without killing him. Years back, I was asked to give a talk in the Four Noble Truths. It was a, to make a very long story short, it was the person who had organized it was a, well, the people who had organized it was a Tibetan group down in Long Beach. And they had invited people from different Buddhist traditions to talk about different Buddhist teachings that most of the different traditions had in common. And I was asked to do the Four Noble Truths. And so at the end of the talk, this one guy comes up, sits down next to me, and turns to the audience and says, okay, what you just heard was a very dualistic interpretation of the Dharma. Next week we'll have, you know, the higher level of Dharma, which is all about oneness, non-duality. And I turned to him, I said, look, you know, there are sometimes when duality is a good thing. Like I said yesterday, you have a surgeon operating in your brain. You want the surgeon to know the difference between your right brain and your left brain. And he wasn't fazed, and he kept going on and on about how, you know, narrow-minded dual thinking was. And so, in self-defense, I raised my hand, and he jumped about a foot. And I said, I thought you were beyond dualities. And I got a good laugh from the audience. The guy never forgave me. I never spoke to him. So. Right effort is the next one. This case where a monk generates desire, endeavors, arouses persistence, upholds, and exerts his intent. For the sake of the non-arising of evil unskillful qualities that have not yet arisen, for the sake of the abandoning of evil unskillful qualities that have arisen, for the sake of the arising of unskillful qualities that have not yet arisen, and for the maintenance, confusion, non-confusion, increase, plenitude, development, and culmination of skillful qualities that have arisen. This is called right effort. We discussed this yesterday, but it's good to go over a couple of points again. Notice here's where desire fits into the practice. First thing there, you generate desire. And basically, you motivate yourself. There's a passage of Buddha said, this is the sign of wisdom, is your ability to live. If something is unpleasant to do, but you know it's going to give good results, you know how to talk yourself into doing it. That's a sign of wisdom. Or if something is pleasant to do, but you know it's going to give bad results, you talk yourself out of doing it. So again, discernment here is practical. It's concerned with actions. Among the various qualities that the Buddha recommends for motivating yourself to the practice, the first one is heedfulness, the realization, if I don't practice, there's going to be trouble. Another one is compassion. I'm doing this for my good and for the good of others. Another one is shame. I would be ashamed not to practice. I've had this opportunity. The opportunity has come into my life. It'd be a real shame if I didn't act on it. Another one is pride. I've gotten this far in the practice. I don't want to throw it away. All that goodness I've done, I don't want it to go to waste. You take a sort of craftsman's pride in the practice. All those are ways in which you can generate desire for these qualities. The other aspect of discernment has to be used, of course, we mentioned yesterday as well, is that you have to figure out, okay, given this situation, what's the kind of effort I need to do? Are there things that I need to develop? Are there things that I need to let go? Things I need to prevent? there's another sutta where the Buddha goes into other cases. One is, on the one hand, you learn how to tolerate some things. Learn how to tolerate specifically unpleasant words and painful feelings. When an unpleasant sound comes to your ear, you leave it just at the unpleasant sound. And don't go into, who is that? Why are they talking, saying that thing to me? There's another passage where the Buddha talks about how there are different kinds of speech you're going to hear in the human world. There is pleasant speech and there is unpleasant speech. There is hurtful, there is well-intentioned speech and ill-intentioned speech. There is kind speech and unkind speech. And you stop to reflect, okay, when unkind, hurtful, untrue, whatever speech comes your way, is this something new and unheard of? No, it's all over the world. So it's how, you know, learn how not to get worked up about it. My teacher had a student one time who was, she was a nurse and she was very good looking. And it seemed to be a lot of the other nurses working in her hospital kind of jealous, and so they liked to gossip about her. And she was overhearing the gossip a lot of times, so she was getting really tired of it. And one day she was meditating with him, and she got this vision of herself in this hall of mirrors, looked in this direction of just more and more reflections of her this way, more and more reflections of her the other way. She started reflecting, oh, this is kind of like, she'd been through this gossip many, many times, many, many lifetimes. She was getting kind of tired of the whole thing. And so she mentioned this to him after she came out of meditation, thinking that he would give a nice kind of consoling message. And he says, well, you were the one who stuck your nose in and became a human being. What do you expect? So that's one way of dealing with unpleasant speech. Is it, this is just a natural part of being a human being. If I wanted to avoid this, I shouldn't have signed on. You find that funny?
I was just thinking of the whole scenario, yeah, choose being born, yeah, I do.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Come to the human realm, it's too bad there's no guidebook or handbook or what you can expect. But what you, the whole point of this is to learn how to depersonalize the situation. So it's not just happening to you, then you can deal with it. As for dealing with pain, as we were saying earlier, that requires more skill in how not to identify with the pain, how not to burden yourself with the pain. As I was saying earlier, the best guidance I know in that direction is a book by Ajahn Mahabua called Straight from the Heart, where there's lots of Dharma talks on how to deal with pain and sort of separate yourself from the pain and not feel burdened. Okay, there are things that you tolerate, but there are also things you learn how to avoid. I love the list that the Buddha gives here. You learn how to avoid swamps. You learn how to avoid cesspools. You learn how to avoid sleeping cows at night. In other words, okay, use your common sense. Don't go out and put yourself in difficult situations and learn how to avoid things when you see them coming. There's a story they tell in Chinese martial arts circles. There was going to be a demonstration one time where this one teacher's student's going to show off their martial arts skills. It was going to be in a pavilion out in the forest. And on the road to the pavilion, there was a donkey on the side of the road. And this donkey was well known in the area for being a nasty donkey. And so as some of the students come along, they say, well, let's show off our skills a little bit first before we get to the pavilion. And one of them goes up to the donkey and tries one of his stances, and the donkey kicks him across the road. The second one comes out, you fool, that's not how it's done. He goes up with another stance, he gets kicked across the road. And all the students try their different stances and they all get kicked across the road. So they say, well, let's see how this master handles this one. So they hide behind the bushes on the side of the road and they watch as the master comes. He sees the donkey and he walks way around. So there are some things you learn how to avoid. And there are other things where it says that you don't tolerate. And the things you don't tolerate are any thoughts of ill will, any thoughts of harmfulness, any thoughts of sensuality. Okay, these things come up, you learn how to do away with them. You don't just let them hang there or take over your mind. Now, as we mentioned yesterday, there are times sometimes when you have to sit with these things so you can understand them. But again, your purpose of sitting with them is not to let them overcome you, it's so that you get past them. You can figure them out. So that's the second aspect of discernment in right effort, which is figuring out what type of effort is needed. And then the third one is figuring out how much. We talked about the example yesterday of Sona, the monk who was walking too much in his walking meditation. Sometimes it's determined by your level of energy. Sometimes it's determined by the problem you have. Jhamma Mahapu's example is you come into the sala, which is the meditation hall at the monastery, and there's this big pile of shit in the middle of the floor. Now you're not going to get it out there with teaspoonfuls of water. You take a big hose or bucketfuls of water and you wash it out. In other words, sometimes just right is pretty extreme. Other times it's something that's very delicate. Of course, very, very precise, not much effort, but a lot of precision. So figure out, okay, what does this particular task require? That's an important question you ask in right effort. Any questions on right effort? Yes?
Would you say in right effort towards the internal speech around habitual kind of, well, could have been better, you know, kind of evaluate skillful, unskillful, and well done skillful, could have done that better, and it becomes really a burdensome thing. Mm-hmm. And kind of debilitating in a lot of ways.
Okay, if it's getting to be debilitating, then you turn around, okay, what am I going to do with this speech? And ask yourself, okay, what satisfaction do I get out of this speech? When you grew up, was there somebody in the family who liked to criticize you without end? Maybe you've internalized that and figure out, if I can figure out what's wrong before they figure out what was wrong, then I'll be ahead of the game. Or it's just becomes a kind of a habitual habit. Look for why you like doing that.
What's driving it?
What's driving it, yeah. Energy. What's the energy? Is it a fear energy? Is it a... Look for the energy behind it, yeah. And again, we regard it as one member of the committee, because you've got other members as well. Because it's, I mean, the ability to reflect on your actions and find something wrong with them. If it's done skillfully, it's an important part of developing a skill. It's just that here it's gotten out of hand. So, but just think about something for once. Okay, the next time that comes around, I'm going to try it. I know that didn't work. Let's try it next. Because the whole purpose of that kind of thinking, if it's going to be helpful, is figure out another way to do it. So we're something. What would have been a better way to do it? And then next time that happens, okay. Because you do have to live with the fact that, as Kierkegaard said, we live forward, but we understand backwards. We look back on what we did, we can understand that pretty well, where it was wrong, where it was right. But as we're moving forward, we're not really sure. At the very least, you can say, whatever I can learn from that, let me apply that next time. And if that doesn't put an end to the criticism, you say, okay, I think it's gotten out of hand. There was a study they did one time, and I forgot what the university was, where they teach brain surgery. And they're trying to figure out, when you get candidates coming in, how do you figure out who's going to be a good candidate for as a brain surgeon, who's not? Because everybody who applies has straight A averages. It's not that. The grades are good. But just because your grades are good doesn't mean you're going to be good with a knife in your hand. With somebody's open brain right in front of you. And so they interviewed people who had failed. And invariably, they found that people who had failed had not really taken credit for their mistakes. One. And two, if they did recognize the mistake, they didn't think about what they could have done better the next time. And so that became the two questions that they asked as the applicants coming in. Can you tell us a mistake that you made recently? And you get people with real ego problems, they're not going to talk about their mistakes in front of committees. But again, if they wouldn't talk about the mistake, they fail. And then the second question, okay, you made that mistake. How would you have done it differently? And if they hadn't spent any energy into thinking about how they would have done it differently, they were apt to. So if there's a healthy use of reflection like that, it's for the purpose of next time that happens, I'll do it better. Recognize the fact, okay, I can live with the fact I've made mistakes in the past, but I don't have to repeat them. That's a healthy balance.
And you talked about mindfulness having this looking back quality, so that I guess that kind of reflection builds strength for mindfulness.
Right, because you think back and okay, I could have done that better this time, and let's give it a try and try something else next time. Mm-hmm. So that when you meet with the situation, you've got that on call. Mm-hmm. This is another one of the reasons why mindfulness as memory is a much more useful function than mindfulness is just kind of being in the moment. Mm-hmm. Because we are working on a skill. Yeah. Years back, I was asked to give a talk on the karma to a group of people, and I don't want to name names, but it was a famous meditation center. Mm-hmm. And the whole burden of the talk was to convince them that karma was actually relevant to meditation. And so I talked about, you know, the whole issues of skillfulness and developing skills as a meditator, and I kept getting these blank looks out of the audience. And I found out later that they've been taught mindfulness. You know, meditation is not a skill, it's just learning how to be there. There's no such thing as a good meditation, no such thing as a bad meditation, just kind of be there. And I said, okay, but to that matter of meditation, I guess karma would be irrelevant. But it's still irrelevant for your life. Okay, right mindfulness we've been talking about all weekend, so let's go into right concentration. Now, right mindfulness is the theme of right concentration. In other words, if you're focusing on either the body or the feelings or mind states or these mental qualities, you're doing your proper duty with ardency, you're going to get the mind into concentration. Now, concentration here is, these are called the four jhanas. The word jhana is related to a verb jayati, which means to burn. Now, Pali has several verbs for burning. And jayati is the burning of an oil lamp. In other words, the flame is steady. You can actually read by it, as opposed to the burning of a pile of logs or the burning of something where the flames flicker and flash. This is a steady flame, and the idea being that you focus on your object with that same steadiness and the same clarity that you would have in an oil lamp. There's a case where a monk, quite secluded from sensuality, secluded from unskillful qualities, enters and remains in the first jhana. Rapture and pleasure born of seclusion accompanied by directed thought and evaluation. Okay, let's go over those terms. Secluded from sensuality is, in other words, you're secluded from sensual thoughts. You're interested in sensual thoughts. Sometimes you see that interpreted as being totally cut off from all your senses, but that's not, there's no basis for that in the canon. Sometimes you hear it translated as, and I actually in the past I used to do this, secluded from sensual pleasures. It means you've got to be, it sounds like you have to be in jail or something. No. You're secluded from sensual thoughts. Secluded from unskillful qualities, that means everything from wrong view right up through wrong concentration. You enter and remain in the first jhana, rapture. Rapture is a quality, as we said, of refreshment. Pleasure, in the sense it can also be translated as ease, well-being, bliss. Born of seclusion, okay, this is a rapture pleasure that comes from the fact that you're cut off from disturbing mind states. Accompanied by directed thought and evaluation. Now, to compare this with the breath, you are thinking about the breath, you're evaluating the breath. Evaluation means several things. One is the breath comfortable? Two, if it is comfortable, what do I do with that sense of comfort? And then three, once you've done something with a sense of comfort, did you do that well? Could you do it better? That's all what evaluation deals with. The analogy that the Buddha gives for this is of a bathman or bathman's apprentice taking bath powder and mixing it with water. Back in those days, they didn't have soap or bars of soap the way we have. They would have a bathing powder. You'd mix it with water and then you'd rub it over your skin. It's kind of like bathing with bread dough. And they would mix it together, and in the same way that you would mix bread dough, you want to make sure that the water is enough for the flour. Not too much, not too little. And the same thing, you knead it through the dough. In the same way, you take the sense of pleasure and rapture, and you knead it through the body. That's the first jhana. Second jhana, with the stilling of directed thoughts and evaluations, you enter and remain in the second jhana, rapture and pleasure born of concentration. unification of awareness free from directed thought and information in internal assurance. Okay, at this point, there's a sense of well-being that's pervaded the body. And you don't need to think about it much anymore. You just focus in, and that process of the pleasure spreading through the body, the rapture spreading through the body, that continues on its own without you having to do anything. You have a sense of unification of awareness. That means that your sense of your awareness and the breath are one. But the first jhana is like you're here watching the breath there, and the second jhana, you've kind of moved into the breath. And your sense of awareness and the breathing are one. Sometimes people talk about it, it's like all of a sudden the body is breathing itself, you're not doing the breathing anymore. The image here is of a lake that has a spring at the bottom of the lake, and the spring keeps, the cool water from that spring keeps welling up and suffusing the entire lake. Any questions on those first two jhanas before we move on to the next two?
Is a thought still there?
You're just thinking breath, 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 breath. That's a perception.
Okay.
But you're not evaluating it anymore.
So it kind of like, it just, the thought just come in, but I don't pay interest in that. I'm just with the breath there.
Yeah. There may be a little bit of chatter in the background, but you're not paying any attention to it. Just one with the breath.
Why isn't the term jhana translated?
Because I haven't found a good
translation.
And the PTS used to call it musing, which sounds really bizarre. Sometimes you hear it translated as trance, and you're not in a trance. The closest thing is absorption. You're absorbed in the breath. And sometimes it's good for you to learn a little Pali.
Did I get that right? That you had said that in the second jhana, the breath and awareness are...
They seem to become one.
Yeah. And, but they're separate in the first?
Yeah.
I just wonder why absorption doesn't sit right with you.
Why doesn't it sit right? I don't know, I just heard jhana so many times, it just sounds like English now. You know? In Thai, they take a lot of their vocabulary, just lift it straight from Pali. That has a good side and a bad side. The good side is you don't have to translate that much. The bad side is that almost every Pali word that has been lifted into Thai gets its meaning changed when it gets into Thai. Mm-hmm. Like vedana, which is translated as feeling, means pity in Thai. Sanya, perception, also means contract or agreement, promise. Sankara means your body. Vijnana means spirit or ghost.
Yeah.
So the words change them, which makes it very difficult. Mm-hmm. By in Thailand, they do temporary ordinations. You know, men will, especially during the Rains Retreat, they'll be ordained for 3 months. And my teacher hated this. He said, you know, you turn these people into monks, and by the time you finally got them into monks, they disrobe. You know?
Mm-hmm.
And even before they disrobe, they're thinking about next month I'm going to disrobe, and then everything starts unraveling. And so as soon as I got old enough as a monk in order to look after the junior monks, he handed them all over to me.
Mm-hmm.
And one of my jobs was to teach them the basic Dharma textbook. They have Dharma textbooks and actually Dharma exams for young monks. And a lot of the problem was just this, saying when sanya does not mean contract, it means perception. Vijnana does not mean ghost, it means consciousness, that kind of thing. So that's one of the disadvantages of just lifting terms. But one of the advantages is that if you start reading Pali, you've got a leg up.
Do they use the different words in the context of the sentence, or I mean, do they literally mean one thing all the time?
Well, what happens is that when you're giving a Dharma talk, it will mean one thing, and when you're in a conversation, it means something else, which means that people who've heard these terms only in everyday conversation, they go hear a Dharma talk and say, this doesn't make any sense. you're clinging to ghosts, you're clinging to The other problem they had in Thailand, which I found really fascinating, was that started around in the 1960s. People started getting university educations. They realized that there were a lot of English terms for which there were no Thai terms. And so the first approach was to take a pre-existing Thai terms and give them a new meaning. Like Rupa Dhamma, which literally means physical phenomenon, that became concrete as opposed to abstract. Nama Dhamma, mental, became abstract. Which, when you're thinking in that particular field, is okay. You can make up any word you want to. But again, but people trained in this, coming to the Dhamma, get very confused. I ran into a woman who was educated about that time in Thailand, since living in France. And she translated the John Lee into French, a Thai book. And I had to read over her translation. And there's one point where John Lee is saying, at this point your meditation goes from focusing on physical things to focusing on mental things. And she translated it, moves from focusing on concretes to focusing on to abstraction. And I said, no. So that's another problem translating Pali. Okay, that's the second jhana. Any other questions on the first two jhanas? Yes?
Just coming back to the absorption thing. So in using that word or thinking about jhana in that way, you know, I think I'm getting absorbed in a novel or something, right? You're reading and you're concentrated enough.
Yeah.
You enter this world. Is that a useful parallel?
That's useful. That's a useful parallel. Because the Buddha does point out there are times when you can be absorbed, and use a word that where it's kind of like Johnny, you can be absorbed in greed, and you can be absorbed in anger, and you can be absorbed in delusion. Now that's not the kind of thing that he's talking about, but he recognizes it, uses the word jhana for that. It's kind of an absorption.
Which is kind of a loss of self, a sense of...
You're just totally goodness. Into it.
Yeah.
And it's not so much a loss of self, it's a loss of things that are interfering with your sense of self. We talk about people being in the zone and losing their sense of self when they're in the zone. It's not losing their sense of self, it's a sense of total power. There's nothing obstructing your will at that point. And when there's no obstruction to your will, you don't become very conscious of the fact that you have a very strong sense of self in there.